Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hello, my wonderful, wonderful guests. I just did a webinar on Tuesday that should be up on, did I say guests or did I say audience? You know, I'm thinking of both because I have a wonderful, wonderful guest, Tom Ryan. Let me just check and make sure he's connected. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, you sound good too. He's well connected, but to my wonderful, wonderful audience as well. It's been an exciting week. So I did a webinar for Madden America, MIA, maddenamerica.com, in which I talked about the range of dangers of medications, how they work, what their history is, and then went on to talk about and to interact with the audience about how to stop taking psychiatric medications. And it's part of a seven-part series. I was number six, that you can get to through a MAD in America. I strongly recommend that. I have been looking and following what's been happening in Florida, and I want to tell you about one of the shootings down there, about one of the perhaps greatest ironies I've ever seen covered by the New York Times without so much as a wink or a nod to the implications of it. And that is that, you know, all this effort's going into saying we need more psychiatry, more mental health, more going into the homes and inspecting people and more interventions. And, you know, this could very well lead to stuff we've been fighting for years, like the programs in the schools to screen kids and screen their families and so on. Well, the fellow Cruz, who became this mass murderer, was enmeshed in the psychiatric system. He was taking psychiatric drugs. We don't know as yet which ones, but of real great interest, about a year or so ago, someone informed the Florida Department of Children and Families that Cruz was talking about guns and killing people and had mental problems and they should intervene. And they actually made a home visit to his family, which was him and his mother. And this is just not long before she died. And the mother reassured them that he was getting help, that he didn't have any guns, which he probably didn't at the time, and that he was getting psychiatric help. So the agency investigators got in touch with the prescriber and found out that he was taking his unspecified psychiatric drugs regularly, and it was because he was getting psychiatric drugs. And remember, he was diagnosed with ADHD and depression. Because he was regularly taking his medicine, he was safe. Now, I mean, isn't that the most ugly and horrible irony? we're going to keep finding that many of these school shooters, as we go along, will be enmeshed in psychiatry. Even among the many we've looked at so far, most of them have been through psychiatry, which tells you it didn't help, probably made them worse. Sometimes just the humiliation of going through psychiatry makes people more angry and more uncontrollable and more desperate and feeling more hopeless because they haven't been helped by psychiatry. Now, as for the sophistication of these intervention teams that are sent out, one of the participants reported the following on this visit over a year ago. Quote, Mr. Cruz stated he plans to go out and buy a gun. I mean, think about that. He's going to go out and buy a gun, and he's on psychiatric drugs. That's how much, and he's fine. That's how much we can trust mental health interventions as they are currently developed to save us, protect us, or help us. They're making things worse all the time. So I'm going to be writing about this soon again, and stay in touch with me through my frequent alerts. They're free. You can sign up for them, and you'll get the latest information. I'll try to let you know about upcoming radio shows. I haven't been doing that yet. I'll certainly let you know, as I always do, about my blogs or blogs that are on our Honored Blogger series. I'll let you know about important news items. And don't forget my website, Bregan.com. So there's a lot of information, and I'm just going to be putting out more and more and more information on that website. We have been growing leaps and bounds. We have had days now of single visitors of over 10,000. So on a single day. And also, don't forget, you can sign up for my videos. You can go there and log on to my video channel, and you'll get notices about that. You can let people know that like the 250,000 people who've seen the one on my the myth of the biochemical imbalance, that that we're just doing a lot of very interesting and important things. So that's all there. Now, today I'm really looking forward to learning stuff, getting new insights, new understandings from a really wonderful man. I've met him. I've invited him to speak at my conferences over the years. His family, his marvelous family, has visited with me and spent time at our home. And he's a pediatrician. Name is Thomas Ryan, Tom Ryan. His practice is in Cartersville, Georgia. He went to a college not far from me at Syracuse University, and did his med school and pediatric residency at the SUNY Stony Brook out on Long Island. He's really a New Yorker. Didn't talk like a New Yorker. And we first met about 5 years ago, and I'll let him talk about how he became involved in being a pediatrician who doesn't psychiatrically medicate his kids. And this man has a lot to offer, and I just want to encourage him to just talk about his practice and his work and his kids and this whole issue of what's happening to America's children. So, Tom Ryan, thank you for coming back on my show.
Oh, thank you, Peter. I was looking through your previous guests just before now, and I'll say it's really an honor to be here with you. It's really an honor to be, to have you invite me, and I'm very, very honored to be here talking to you. You know, you have to keep me focused, because if you didn't tell me that you're going to mention this on the intro, this boy, it's the whole story of ADD and the whole story of the healthcare system. And I would hope that my patients wouldn't end up like he has, but I can see his path. But we can you can help me stay focused and work that in maybe later.
No, let's move on to that. I didn't tell you that, because I usually don't know what I'm going to say for my intro I just sort of get my head together. And so tell me more about that. That sounds so interesting. Don't worry about losing track of things. I got a mental list. And you've got so much wisdom. So that rang true for you, that that this is what happens when you start with ADD and stimulant drugs. Tell me
Let me tell the audience first just briefly about our meeting, because that plays into it. I've been a pediatrician for over 20 years, a general pediatrician, small practice. I always valued, you know, knowing my patients, and I feel like that personal touch is just so efficient. It just helps so much with teaching the moms about things. So I've been a general pediatrician over 20 years, always troubled by prescribing drugs for ADHD. 5 years ago, my brother introduced me to your book, The Facts About Ritalin, The Truth About ADHD, I think the title.
Yeah, Ritalin Fact Book.
Yeah. So I read that book. I read it. I opened it first page. I couldn't put it down. I read, you know, read the whole thing straight and wrote you a letter. And I said, this book has really motivated me to stop altogether prescribing stimulants for attention deficit disorder. And then you called me and talked with me for an hour or so, encouraged me. And so since that time, 5 years ago, I took about a month or two to wean off my patients. I alerted my patients what I was doing. And, you know, since that time, I've not prescribed any stimulants for ADHD, and I've had a, you know, wonderful growth of my, you know, personal growth with helping patients, learning how to counsel them. And I've helped a lot of people in that way. So this boy, the Cruz that you mentioned, when parents ask me, why are you stopping? The main reason I stop isn't because of the side effects of the drugs. The main reason I stop doing it is because I tell them, well, I've been doing it now for 15 years. And really, you start at age 5, and by age 15, they're really no different. So they go through their childhood believing that they have a problem that needs a drug to fix it, and what's going to happen to them going into life. So I said, the main reason I stopped prescribing is for this. I don't want to have them, you, parent, or the people around them or themselves, have a thought that they have a handicap whereby they're unable to function without the drug. So this boy, I don't know if he was on stimulants, but it's I'd say it's very likely. And he got into it. So the people who looked at him, well, that's him. He needs this drug to function. And then it goes on to another drug, and he's into the healthcare system who has a certain bias towards him, and it's like you never get out. And how much does that handicap a person? How much does that influence how other people treat him, how he thinks about himself, how he communicates? And you know, so this was the end game for this poor guy. But those are my thoughts on that.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that also happens, as I'm sure you're aware, is it's a gateway drug. You know, we talk about people smoking marijuana. It's a gateway drug to heavier drugs. Giving a child Ritalin, an addictive amphetamine, is a gateway drug to psychiatric drugs. In this case, it's very possible that his this depression he's described as having, being a depressed person, that's caused all the time by these drugs in children. They suppress you, they make you apathetic, and then you don't have the energy, you can't socialize as well, and you become depressed. And no one sees that it's the Ritalin, so they then put you on antidepressants. And that may be very well the direction that he went in. And we do have long-term studies now showing from the 70s, kids started with mild hyperactivity problems showing up only at school and not in the family, that were put on Ritalin in small doses in the 70s, now are failing in comparison to a rough control group of kids from the Associated Medical Clinic back then. They're just doing poorly everywhere. And it's not because of the Ritalin, as you pointed out. They're not even on Ritalin anymore. Now they're on Abilify, Seroquel, Risperdal. They're very disturbed people because they've become these career mental patients. And I think that a big part of that is what you're describing, Tom, which is them viewing themselves and others viewing them as not able, not competent, unable to do things without the drugs. And then the other issue is just the wearing down of the drugs over the years, when once you get into these really heavy ones especially. So it's a nice nice summary for folks about just what this overall disaster is like, of just simply declaring a kid has ADHD.
And it's a
one
gateway
last thought, and then I want to give it back to you. And now they're saying he was autistic. And the last thing, if you're having trouble with, if you genuinely are autistic, that is by definition, autism is you have trouble relating and communicating with people. And especially you just don't have empathy for people. You don't treat them in a loving, caring way. You may even treat them like the water fountain when you get a drink from it. It's just not like you're relating to a person. Well, to further stifle that person's higher capacities with a stimulant or an antidepressant, I think is criminal. But let me give you back the mic. We're talking to Tom Ryan, pediatrician.
I was going to mention that it's a gateway. Also, it's a gateway not just to addiction to a drug and dependence on a drug. It's a gateway into a system that is dysfunctional. Our healthcare system does not function to help people, but it's a very powerful system, and so it's a gateway into medical doctors, psychiatrists, who only have one tool, and that is the prescription pad. There's not, a parent goes for help and they just get this one tool. They're really not a place very well for people to listen to, talk to him about what's happening in his life, friends and, whatever. That's another powerful gateway that you get. It's like you're trapped. You're trapped in this system that just chews you up and makes you worse.
Yeah, thank you for that, Tom. I actually don't emphasize that enough when I talk and when I write. I don't just talk about the system that you then get into that chews you up. And it's the educational system. It's the special classes, and it's the welfare system that often gets involved. I mean, there's so many different systems. Child and family services get involved. It's just this big, awful system that somewhat monitors, but doesn't have any therapeutic educational tools that are really going to help a kid. Doesn't know how to help parents help a child. I need to talk more about that gateway to this awful system. So it's a gateway to psychiatric drugs. It's a gateway into an awful system. And one more gateway I didn't mention, the stimulants are a gateway into using cocaine when you become a young adult, because they affect your brain so that you crave stimulants. That's why they're addictive. And cocaine and amphetamine are extremely close in their chemical actions, very, very close. So it's a gateway into a tragic life.
Yeah.
And this is very good. I'm so glad that we're getting into this subject, which we didn't even touch about when we were chatting today. By the way, folks, I'm still on my vegetable plant-based diet, which means I get hungry more often. And before I realized it, I realized I was munching on cereal while I was talking to Tom on the phone. He could barely hear me. So there's a hazard of doing the plant-based diet. You'll want to eat a little more, but boy, will you lose weight. I'm just doing wonderfully on it. And folks, you can go back and go to Pam Popper. Go to my website, go to the radio show, and you can look up everybody who's been on. You can see Tom's earlier shows. You can see Pam Popper and I talking about nutrition, real nutrition. How are you doing without giving psychiatric meds to your patients? Tell me what kind of life that's making for you and them and their families.
Well, for my office, life is a lot better, because it was such a strain on me to do something that I felt was wrong. So in that sense, if I could go back 5 years and compare my day to today, and that's a big burden that's been lifted. I believe I've helped a lot of people. I don't prescribe them at all anymore. So that phase of getting people off, which, by the way, wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it would be. Most parents at that time said, oh, great, I never wanted to take them anyway. So now my life in the office is largely, I think, anticipatory. You know, you can tell the child who's going to have struggles with focus and attention when they're 2 years old, when they come for visits. And I'm trying to teach them, you know, how to train your child at that early age. So I'm hoping that I'm preventing a lot of ADD. The ones who come in, they're older and are struggling with it. I sit down and, you know, I spend time talking about the nuts and bolts of their life. You know, where do you do your homework? What time of day? What time do the parents get home from work? One thing I think helps a lot is if the father can spend 10 or 15 minutes at the end of his day just reviewing the child's homework with him, that helps. You know, people say, I don't have time. I say, just dad, okay, your homework worked late. Spend 10 minutes with your son. Review the homework. Tell him that you're expecting him to, you know, to do that every night, and you're really proud of him for doing that. Have, you know, those kind of things is what I counsel about, and it's helpful. I mean, you wouldn't believe the basic common sense things that seem obvious, but people forget about it. It's like, oh yeah, he's got to do homework. The same thing, you know, there's some basic stuff that people forget about that, if you just spend time interviewing, you can make some, helpful improvements there. So I just met a patient, you know, just this week. It was a boy that, was one of the first ones that I had stopped 5 years ago. He has Asperger's and autism. And he was on a high dose of something or other back then. I talked to the mom. I said, well, I'm going to wean him off this. We did it. He's the smartest kid in his class. He's 15 now. He's the smartest kid in his class. You know, mom's really proud of him. The teachers love him. So those are kind of success stories that I have with it. I don't get any parents these days, demanding it. You know, I thought when I first stopped doing this that they'd be beating the door down saying, please, Dr. Ryan, please, you know, just for me, please. But I don't have that at all. I don't have that at all. It's a pretty easy argument to make the way I put it. And so in that way, it's going really, really well.
Do you think that may have something to do with being in Athens, Georgia? Maybe it's more family oriented. Maybe it's more skeptical about the claims of science. I'm wondering if you wouldn't have more trouble here in the university town of Ithaca, New York. What do you think of where people believe in doctor in science, you know, pseudoscience?
I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not. I think the school systems and the teachers still push it pretty hard in their philosophy. But maybe it's easier.
Yeah, I said Athens, Georgia, Carterville, Georgia, excuse me.
Yeah.
Are you near a big university there?
I'm about an hour from Atlanta, so Emory, CDC, yeah. Emory. Yeah.
So you don't think it's your population, you just think it's talking sensibly to parents?
I do. I think that a lot more people than they realize are uncomfortable with it, but they do it because they think they're supposed to. They do it because they think that's the best thing for the child, and they kind of roll over on it.
It sounds like your practice is more fun and more satisfying, and you feel like you're doing much more good in terms of these children. What percentage of your practice is involved in counseling folks?
Well, I guess as I get older, the counseling, I just can't hold it in you can do it on every visit, no matter what they come for, just about. But especially with checkups, how's the child doing? How's the sleeping? And you know, the behavior issues come up always at the top for toddlers. So I, you know, as much as possible with my day, I try to teach about child rearing. I try to encourage them to maybe do it a different way than they're doing it. So, you know, much of my practice is counseling these days. Much of my practice, even so many sick visits, are really have a heavy social component to them. Or, you know, headaches, abdominal pain, fatigue, not sleeping well. I mean, the root of all of those. You know, you need to counsel them on something or other. So I do as much as I can. I do as much because I know that's what's going to really be at the root of their problems.
You said something to me very interesting when we were first talking. You said that the regular childhood illnesses are under pretty good control now. And so a lot of what you're seeing, you said, were, I think you said, autism and obesity and ADHD were the designated disorders now that the pediatricians were mostly seeing.
Yeah, in my work, those are the big hard issues for these kids. The big things that are going to affect their life. It isn't meningitis, polio. You know, those things happen, but we have specialty hospitals, and they're so rare that it's not a common thing at all anymore. But what's going to really affect their long-term health, I would say the big ones are ADHD issues, autism, and obesity.
You want to talk about each of them? We're talking about ADHD. By the way, as far as I know, you never went out and got trained in counseling. You've just been using common sense and the fact that you've raised a great family as your basis of work, isn't it?
Yeah. So maybe that's a disclaimer. I've never had training. You know, I wish I had, but your book has been helpful, but, you know, your book and in raising my own kids has given me a lot of confidence. And then, you know, it evolves. So I've been doing it for some years and I kind of find out what works and what doesn't work. But, you know, it's not complicated. What I emphasize to the parents is patience and love, paying attention to the child, listening well, and being a proper authority. You know, not a cruel tyrant, but, you know, I think the children need you to be in control, be in charge of the situation. And I'd say that's the biggest lie, I'll say, that people are believing now is that the mothers are supposed to just let the child kind of raise himself and just let him ask questions, let him experiment and figure out the world on his own, whatever he wants to do, just, you know, follow him around and let him do it. That's getting people into a lot of trouble. So, you know, that's what's worked for me. I teach parents how to correct their child lovingly but firmly. You know, they're so resistant to do that. They're so resistant to say no to their child. I mean, every day, 10 times a day, these toddlers are pushing things around my office, banging cabinets, you know, and the parents just let them do it. And I'll go in the room and I'll say, hey, Johnny, I need to talk to your mom. Sit in that chair and be quiet. And they look at me like, where'd this guy come from? And they just do it. But they do it. And it's a good demonstration for the mother. You know, I recommend, mom, that you take charge of the situation. It's okay to say no to him. It's okay for him to learn some self-control. So that's really a big thing. And they're so resistant initially. They're very resistant to do that. I guess they've been taught that it's unhealthy. It's unloving. It's better if he decides on his own. And I say, well, there's a time and a place for that. But when they're two, they don't have the capacity to make a proper decision. They need you to make these decisions for them. So I'm not sure how I got talking about that. You were mentioning counseling, I guess. And
yeah, this is all so important, what you're saying. And, folks, this is what I do. I mean, there really is essentially no difference between how I would describe what I'm doing with parents and their kids, every bit of it, including modeling for the parents that when I, in a loving, caring way, tell little Johnny or Jane to do something, they almost always do it. And If not, I can playfully usually bring them around to realizing they're supposed to do what I'm saying. And
yeah.
And then I tell them that they're going to have to do the same thing with their mom and their dad. And I talk to mom and dad about it. In fact, I have a whole chapter in that book that you initially read, the Ritlin Pack book. I just so much in line with what you're saying, which is that the big issue for most of the parents that we see in modern times is that they don't believe in being moral authorities. They don't even have an expectation that if they tell their child, you're misbehaving, you have to sit and be quiet or go up to your room, that they're going to do it. They'll look you in the eye and say they'll never do it. And I explain to them that, you know, as they develop these techniques of only asking for things that are reasonable and rational and being loving and caring, but absolutely insistent and having a look in your eye that says you absolutely expect them to obey and that's it. That in itself will bring around most children to calming themselves down in your presence and for themselves and doing much better. It's no mystery, and it goes along very much with my own thinking, which is that if you have a good person, and especially if they've had experience raising children and experience in life, they can easily learn to be a therapist. And I'm going to get around soon, I think, to, we're talking, Pam Popper and I are talking about developing a program that will give a certificate to people with or without any kinds of degrees on being a helpful person. We haven't got the name quite down yet, whether it'll be empathic coaching or whatever, but it'll be, counseling, helping, talking. And that isn't something that is vastly improved by degrees. I don't know about you, Tom, but I had to debrief from medical school. I had to overcome what was done in my residency in order to become a good human being talking to my clients and patients. I didn't get a lot of help from my training in that. I got some, but a lot I got the reverse.
Yes. If we can just, if you can just listen to a person and then if they know you've heard them, they know that you've heard what their problem is, and then you can gently say, well, you know, this is how I see it and this is what I've done. Try this. It's so powerful. It really is. So I think your idea of a coaching certificate, empathic coach, wow, that's what we need. That's what this poor guy in Florida needed. And it can go so far to help people.
Well, that's encouraging. That's encouraging. Well, Pam and I are hoping to put something together in the next few months and maybe even have it ready by our conference in November in Ohio and to go ahead and, have some workshops on it and stuff like that. I just admire so much your genuineness, your honesty, your wisdom. Again, folks, we're talking to pediatrician Tom Ryan. You were telling me that some people come to see you all the way from other states because their doctors won't see them because they're not going to take one or another vaccine. Is that something we should talk a little bit about? It's a third rail, as my wife, she'd say, honey, don't put your foot on that third rail. But
Well, to me, it's related a lot to communication. It's related a lot to human communication, human problem solving. So in that sense, I think we can talk about it and not get too deep into the main controversies of it. But so I don't know if you know about meaningful use. Have you heard of meaningful use? You don't do medical billing, but
no.
about 10 years ago, I guess, when they wanted to get all doctors to use electronic medical records, they offered incentives. So if you get a government-approved electronic charting, then you can we'll pay for that. But there's strings attached, so you've got to be compliant. And and there's lots and lots of things. Doctors, I mean, totally frustrated. So if you go to a doctor's office and the nurse is like clicking 10,000 boxes, that's meaningful use. You know, did you have a car seat? You know, do you speak English? Do you have guns in the house? All these types of questions, they're audited on. So did you ask 85% of your patients if they spoke English or Spanish? So that's like an example of, I just made that up, but it's not too far from the way it is. But one of them that they get audited on is vaccines. So pediatricians, I guess, to solve this problem, so they don't get dinged on their getting that money that they've committed to. They just tell patients, if you don't do all the vaccines, then you can't be a patient here. And it's a huge thing. I mean, I think I'm the only doctor in Georgia. Maybe there's two pediatricians. I mean, it's overwhelmingly the belief of pediatricians that all children must get all vaccines on time. So yes, I have patients that come from all over because I'm the only doctor that they know of that would even see them. It's interesting because these people are not like anti-vaccine. By and large, they're not anti-vaccine. They just want to talk. They just want to talk about it. And they say, well, could I maybe do the chicken pox later? No, you can't come here, you know. And so they just want to talk about it. And so it's these people who come to me, by and large, they get vaccinated. Whereas if they went by what that other doctor said, he kicked them out, they wouldn't get any vaccines because he's not going to see them. But they come to me, I listen to them, we make a plan. You know, I hear them out on what ones make them uncomfortable. I give them my opinion on how what I've seen and what I think, and we come up with a plan and work through it just fine. So that kind of dovetails with listening well and working with people.
I think it's one of the great keys to life. Just not overwhelming people with authority, listening to them, trying to make some sense out of what they're saying, trying to help them make decisions, and feeling free to give advice. You know, nowadays we've talked about how parents get the idea they're not supposed to direct their children or give them moral direction or moral advice, which is what I think is a huge part of parenting. And, counselors are trained not to give people advice either and not to talk about themselves and their own experience. So when I train counselors, which I've done a considerable amount of in departments of counseling, they're just amazed that I want them to draw on their own experience and I want them to make suggestions from their own wisdom and to just to share with their clients what some of what they know. And because just an outsider looking in who's caring and reasonably rational, can contribute a great deal to helping somebody along. If you've been listening carefully to what they've been doing. Now, with the autistic children, do you work with the parents? We're talking about autistic. You're talking about a broad spectrum, I gather. I mean, there are not that many real autistic kids around. I mean, the children who are unable to relate and lack empathy and treat their parents like tables and chairs and other people. I mean, that's it. That was the original definition of it. And even now, the DSM-5, people don't even know this. There's nothing about any disease processes or neurological disorders. It's autism spectrum disorders is a variety and degree of communication and relationship problems. And what do you think about this emphasis on autism, Tom? We didn't exactly get down to that. What does it mean?
Well, I would agree for sure that it's an epidemic of autism in a sense that when I was in residency, and this was back in the mid-90s, I don't remember hardly seeing a patient that anybody would say was autistic, you know, but now it's every day I have patients that, now I'm using the word autistic in the very broad way that I guess most people use it, even doctors, is a child who has significant communication problems with screaming, and, you know, not connecting with you and what's going on in the room. I see that every day. I'd say almost every day I see it. A lot of times I see it evolving. I see it evolving from this relationship with the mom, I guess I'll say, the parent. I see it evolving from a child who is calling all the shots. And so often, and it's hard to say this. I guess I'm saying it to a broad audience now, but you know, you don't want to come across as blaming anybody, blaming the mother, but we got to talk about it. There's many factors, but this boundary issue of the parents not teaching them, you know, what is the boundary and how do you speak and this is what I expect you to do, and so the child, maybe he's in control, he's making all the rules, but he doesn't know what the rules are. So I do see it evolving oftentimes from a dysfunctional relationship with the parents. And I think that's what we got to start talking about more than we have on this matter. And I would say I've, quote, cured autism. I can say that to you a few times. I mean, I'll have a toddler and I'll start talking to the mom about how to correct them, how to say no, and insist that he does things. And I would say that I have helped a lot and brought kids out of a situation that was very bad to one that's normal. That's very, very satisfying. I just had a patient last week where that happened to. It's just wonderful. Just wonderful with that experience.
Yeah, gosh. It's so interesting to talk to you on this depth about it all. I have that experience, folks, too. I've had children come in who were, talking gibberish and acting very bizarre and hiding behind, 8, 9 years old, hiding behind the couch, and who, by careful, loving, firm relating, got them to sit down and calm down and explain to them that that kind of behavior was, just say it with a loving, straight face, is ruinous to your life. You'll never get the attention you need, the love and the approval you need. When you do that, you just get this, people upset. And so the way you're being right now, listening to me, and it's really cool. It's really good. And then maybe the kid does something weird. And I say, no, come back and talk. Come back and talk. Don't do that. And the parents are astounded because they've been taught literally in the doctor's office that that boy can't control his behavior and they can't control it either. So in defense of the parents, and I'm sure you'll love this, I mean, they've been discouraged from exerting their parenthood. And mm-hmm. One of the most disturbed children I ever saw in my office, I helped the parents change their behaviors, and that boy has just done wonderfully. I see him around the community. I mean, mm-hmm. before you looked at him across the crowd in the room and you knew there was something desperately the matter. Not now. He's really doing great. And this has happened with one child of mine who was so disturbed. We couldn't get him off his psych drugs. I actually got the University of Rochester psychiatric department to take him in to get him off drugs. I got a couple of other professionals to help me convince the department. They did it, and they took him off his meds. And he's now doing very well, moved out of town. He's doing very well. And it's really simple stuff. All the things that Tom is saying that you are saying pertain to this. You teach the parents and you exemplify with the child normal relating in which you require in a loving, caring, but firm way. You require normal behavior and normal eye contact. And then the child just starts to come out of himself a little bit, and the parents see that and they learn to do that. And in line with what Tom said earlier about getting the father to spend 10 minutes doing homework every night with the child, almost invariably, these children not only have harassed and overworked moms or or anxious moms or moms who are working full time, they are always, almost always, they have DADD. They have dad attention deficit disorder. They're just getting almost nothing from their hardworking fathers. Mm-hmm. And that's in the better families. In the worst ones, they're getting nothing from their derelict fathers. And they just respond so much, children, to their fathers regularly doing things with them, the 10 minutes a night. And one of the things I like to encourage is, Dad, you know, if you've got a couple of kids or three kids or whatever, at least spend a part of a Saturday or Sunday every week with one of them alone. Just go off and go fishing or hunting or eating out or shopping or playing, so that your child knows on a regular basis they're going to be dealing with you and getting your approval and having your love and learning how to grow up from you. Very, very simple stuff, but you got to believe in the basics of what raising children is about. And it's got nothing to do with psychiatry. It's got nothing to do with psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. Yeah. What about oh my gosh, we only have 10 minutes or so left here. Let me say something about, I've been looking into the autism issue lately in terms of the vaccines, particularly the MMR vaccine. And some children are being hurt by the vaccine. I think that the CDC has a review out making clear that certain number of children are getting hurt by the vaccines. But what they tend to get is not autism. They're getting neurological disorders. One CDC survey said that about half the children they looked into in terms of injuries from vaccines had neurological injuries. And a lot of the children in the studies who get labeled autistic, even in the scientific studies, they're not autistic. They had an encephalitis. They start with a fever, chills, nausea, or vomiting, or a headache, abnormal movements. They're sick for a while. That's the key. That's not how autism begins. Autism is a gradually evolving psychosocial disorder. When you have something that responds to a catastrophe, like an inoculation or a hit on the head or, you know, concussion or an encephalitis, that's not autism. That's a neurological injury. And a lot of these children had sometimes minor but lasting problems with cognition, their thought processes. That's not the key to autism. There's not necessarily any cognitive thinking problems with autism. It's a social communication issue, not relating to people. So, yes, there are injuries from the vaccines. How could there not be injuries from them? They have a court that responds to the vaccines and gives money away, a no-fault court that the government runs. Of course there's harm from the vaccines. But whether they should or shouldn't be given, I'm not even going to try to approach at this moment in time. But certainly it's not really autism that they cause. When they injure the way other drugs do, by causing an inflammatory or traumatic process that shows up with physical disorders. Gastrointestinal disorders are very common, and neurological disorders, but it's not autism. The kid may look autistic, but that's because of the injury to the brain. That's not autism. Does that sound make sense? Because I think I'm the only one who's actually articulated this.
I love it. What we could agree on is we don't need to get into whether they should be given or not, but we could agree on that the parents should have heavy say in the matter. And it's not so simple as mandating one perfect schedule for everybody in the country, and if you don't like it, you don't have a doctor and you can't go to school. You know what I mean? That's what gets people really bothered, is the mandating of it. So a parent can't say, well, I've studied MMR and I want to do it later. You know, and so if they want to have a say in it, and that's legitimate. I mean, you know, I'm going to defend that all the way as far as I have to. You know, I think that's in this society we live in, where people are not ravaged by infectious diseases. We can have a little bit of flexibility and give the parents more respect, and you know, let them be the one who decides when it's given, and respect that decision.
Yes, that's beautifully, beautifully put. And to mention one other vaccine, everybody my age is supposed to be getting the flu shot every year. My examination of the science and talking to other people is that it doesn't do much, and it can be harmful. And everybody has to read about this and study this and make their own decisions about it. And that's very much where I come from on all these issues. And Tom comes from it in the same way I do. And again, I'm talking to pediatrician Thomas Ryan, and he's down in Georgia. I wish you were here in Ithaca. Have you met any around the world pediatricians working the way you are, or they just all want to get too rich to do that?
I haven't met them. I mean, there's a famous pediatrician, you know, Bill Sears. Do you know Bill, Dr. Sears, the attachment parenting guy from...
Oh, I know attachment parenting, but I'm not terribly familiar with Bill Sears.
Bill Sears, I think, was heavy into promoting that. He's a pediatrician. He has a son named Bob Sears who thinks the way, I guess, I've been talking about vaccines. He's got a famous, you know, very well-known book, the vaccine book. So I know of him, and there definitely are. There is a group of pediatricians that are friendly towards vaccine schedules or anti-vaccine, but they're very much demonized by the establishment, looked upon as quacks and unscientific. But I don't know any of them around here. I'm, you know, in a broad radius from Cartersville, I'm the only one I know of.
Yeah. Well, you know, money is a real compulsion for people, especially when we've gone to college and studied pre-medical and then gone to medical school and then, you know, internships, residencies, fellowships, or whatever else. And counseling just isn't very high on the payment scale for insurance companies. They don't take into account that you're a psychiatrist doing counseling necessarily, or a pediatrician, and you just don't get paid the same amount that you would if you spent your time giving drugs. I could make four times an hour what I make now, probably, if I was a psychiatrist doing the medications. And that has a powerful effect on how people reason and think. And we were going to talk today, Tom Ryan wanted to talk about belief systems and how people get stuck in them and how do you help them out of them. We've only got about, I imagine, 3 or 4 minutes. I'm going to just find out how much time I've got. But would you like to sort of talk about it for just a few minutes, and then maybe we'll just come back and talk about this again? Or is it too little time?
I'll just mention what I think about.
Yeah.
There's a social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt. He's written a lot of books. He has a book called The Righteous Mind. And he basically is saying, and I agree with this, I mean, it rang so true to me. People don't make decisions based on reasoning and logic. We have firmly held beliefs about things, whether it's vaccines or medications or vitamin supplements or what, child rearing. We believe it by our emotion and our experience and just what we think it is right, much more than we study and reason. So when we're going to persuade somebody, if we want to try to persuade somebody to think differently, we pretty much have to abandon the reasoning as our main tool. You first have to get a relationship with them. But so often we jump to the reasoning and the arguing, and it doesn't work. It can't work because that's not how the person decides in the first place where they're at, whether they realize it or not. And the other thing is, we all think we don't do it. You know, everybody else does that except me. But as I look at my life, how many times I've done that, it's true. You know, it's true. We use our reasoning to justify what we've already decided, basically.
I think that's absolutely true. That sounds like an interesting book. I'm going to The Righteous Mind. I'm going to look into it. I think that's very true. Our ideas support our way of life. They support our spiritual or religious thinking, how we relate to loved ones, to family, what team we root for. You know, who wants to let go of all of that and be overturned? Right. I think one of the important things about upbringing is that so many of the ideas that we will struggle to let go of come from upbringing. And parents need to pick their values and to communicate them to their children in no uncertain terms.
Yeah.
About empathy, love, caring, responsibility, honesty. Parents have to be a model for that, but they also have to show that they approve of all of those behaviors. And one of the most important things folks can also do is just approve the heck out of your children's good behaviors, not their bad ones. You can either ignore the bad ones or say, that's not so good. But or just a little tiny disapproval. But most of what you want to do is just approve and approve and approve the behaviors of your kids whenever they're good. And if you have a kid who gets ugly looks on his face, as soon as he doesn't say, you know, God, you look gorgeous when you're smiling, or, you know, it's been wonderful just sitting here and you've been looking happy and relaxed, makes me happy. And not get in the position of just reprimanding. You want to do almost none of that compared to giving good moral direction and good moral approval. Does that sound right to you, sir, with all your experience and your raising kids so well?
Yeah, I find if I can just go to them and say, hey, Rosie, that kind of hurt my feelings, or that ugly look said something to me and it was hurtful. Let's talk about that. Much more powerful. Much more powerful than any kind of rebuke that's harsh.
Tom, thank you again. Thomas Ryan, pediatrician, Cartersville, Georgia. Just thanks so very, very much for being on the show. It's just a joy to know you and have you as a friend. Thank you. Thanks for listening, my wonderful, wonderful audience. Thank you for being there.